I think employees have still been left, businesses have still been left without structure to give like the advice they're going to need to bring people both in person, but also to bring back a sense of confidence.
Welcome to Fresh Take, a candid interview series featuring thought leaders and innovators from across the Capital Region. These one-on-one conversations highlight the incredible work happening in our communities and showcase both where we are and where we are going as a region.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Fresh Take. I am the CEO of the Greater Washington Partnership, and this is our regular interview series where we focus on learning from leaders across the Capital Region and beyond. My guest today is Dr. Kavita Patel. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to give a short biography of you to everyone, and but thank you again for joining us. Kavita is a non-resident fellow of the Brookings Institute. She was the managing director of clinical transformation at the Center for Health Policy at Brookings. She's a primary care physician in Washington who served in the Obama administration as director of policy for the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Engagement in the White House, where she played a critical role in policy development and evaluation of initiatives connected to health reform, financial regulatory reform, and economic recovery issues. Dr. Patel currently advises healthcare technology and services organizations through an association with New Enterprise Associates. She's a previous Robert Wood Johnson clinical scholar, and while at Brookings, returned to providing clinical care as an internal medical practitioner. Kavita, it's great to have you on. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much to the partnership and JB. I'm looking forward to a hopefully lively conversation about our topic today.
Yeah. It will be, I'm sure. And I wanted to just do a quick run through of some items to just hit, because I know you talk about these all the time, but not everyone necessarily has heard kind of the latest and greatest, and the news oftentimes changes really quickly. So I'll just run through some quick hitting things. But before we do that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how this last year has been for you personally. Mm-hmm. If you could, you know, just share a little bit with the audience, how's your life? How have you been managing your life through that time?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. I hate talking about myself, so I'll just tell you that I don't think I'm out of turn in how my colleagues who are also, I've been in a clinical setting about 3 days a week, and in a clinic, and in the beginning of the pandemic got shut down completely, but actually migrated because they needed us to help with makeshift hospitals, you know, kind of things like that I didn't think I would see in the United States, like field army hospitals, that kind of thing, more trucks backing up to hospitals. Our mid-Atlantic area got hit hard, but nowhere near as hard as some parts of the country, which was good. But at the same time, as months went on and I saw colleagues die, friends die, it just kind of reinforced like how scary all this was. So I essentially retreated into a bubble like many Americans did outside of work. And I think that's had its effects on all of us. So I, for one, I've been able to get vaccinated, I've been able to feel that sense of security that happens when you do get vaccinated, and very confident we will have that sense of security as a country sooner rather than later. I had originally worried that it would be summer or fall when we would start to see some of the things we're actually seeing today, where we can actually get together with others. You can travel with some degree of safety if you take precautions. Schools are opening. I thought that would take several months, so I'm very pleased. And I would just say, like, it's also been sad to see a lot of the small and medium-sized businesses that I had come to frequent so often being shuttered, and thinking about what is not being dealt with by a vaccine, right? A vaccine can save lives, but it can't save an economy. And so it's going to be very, I think it's going to take a lot of us. I think the partnership, I'm very excited about hopefully working with partnerships like yours in to revitalize kind of how we talk about bringing businesses back, bringing employees back safely. I think employees have still been left, businesses have still been left without structure to give like the advice they're going to need to bring people both in person, but also to bring back a sense of confidence. And what we're seeing now is that productivity gain I saw a year ago when people were like, oh, I can be productive on Zoom at home. We're seeing that now wane to some degree. And we're going to have to learn how to adapt to this kind of weird new normal for at least a year. But my colleagues in healthcare, I don't call them heroes, because I think it's like what we were trained to do. But I hope that we also see some improvements out of the healthcare system as a result of it, because the people who have truly been heroes to me have been some of the home care aides, people who are not physicians or the nurses have gotten, have done a lot to help people throughout the pandemic. But I would say home care aides, some of the unsung heroes and the exposure we've seen, people of color, people who have worked for minimum wage or less, but are the people that help elderly parents and disabled people. I always, I have one, I'll stop with this, JB. My experience before the pandemic was that if you haven't understood what it's like to help kind of change the diaper of like an 86-year-old, you don't understand what our country is doing to people who age. And the pandemic has, like many things, revealed the tragedy in a lot of that. So I'm very optimistic, but also hope we don't just ignore the lessons from the past.
Yeah, well, those are great observations and things that we can follow up. I think women, of course, as a category, have also, we've had, you know, 2 million drop out of the workforce already. We talk a lot here about the path to inclusive growth, which is really our mission, is inclusive recovery. And if we can't get to the former without a real focus on the latter.
Right.
Thank you for that. Let me, because you're such an expert, let me address some specific questions for you. We could just rip through these fairly quickly, but sure. Love to get your take. Let me start with vaccines. And I have a very, this is something that's been on my mind for a long time, but we've got new prospective vaccines that don't yet have FDA approval, but, you know, are in use elsewhere, right? AstraZeneca, Novavax looks like it's progressing pretty quickly as well. Why can't the FDA just say, hey, you know, if this is good enough for the UK,
right,
then it's good enough here in an emergency. Why doesn't that just happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I just, you know, part of my bio that's kind of buried is that I worked for years for Senator Kennedy, and we worked on FDA reauthorizations. We actually worked on the Pandemic All Hazardous Prepared Act, which gave us the ability to actually have the emergency use authorization that didn't exist before. So I'm very,
that's a great history lesson.
It is a great history lesson done by part of, you know, Ted Kennedy would tell us that if we weren't working for the people and we weren't working with Republicans, we weren't doing our job. So we did that with Richard Burr, who's obviously still in the Senate. So I think that there's an incredible one, you know, I do think that the commitment to safety and the obligation of the Food and Drug Administration really is to the United States. And so you see, because of statute and authority in that emergency use authorization, is the requirement that we can't really kind of farm out safety to other countries. Now, that's not to say that our standards are that much higher. I will say they are different, though. And we have been cautiously, traditionally, follow the EMA, the European Medicines Agency. The word around the world is that if you have a drug or a therapeutic, the EMA is more likely to approve it first, and the FDA is a little more conservative. And I would say that especially given the conversation about the Russians vaccines, it is okay in my mind to see the US trials being read out and data being done. And it's not because the United States COVID is that much different from France's COVID, but actually it kind of is. And so our wild type strains, the genetic mutations, all these conversations are now becoming much more relevant. So I agree with you. What I will say, JB, is that I think if we fast forward 4 to 6 weeks, we will have emergency use applications from Novavax and AstraZeneca. And I think that those will be number 4 and 5 in our armament. I do think, however, we have enough, apparently, if everything goes as planned, we'll have enough vaccine from the current 3 manufacturers. So then if we have multiple choices, which I think if businesses are listening, we will have multiple choices. I think the struggle will be, okay, how do we make recommendations for our employees? And how do we give some of those excess vaccines to other countries who absolutely need it because they're behind on what they have?
Right. Yeah, that's great. Second question. Do vaccines prevent asymptomatic transmission?
Yeah, we think they do. The preliminary studies, there's now growing evidence that are, and I'll say briefly why it's taken so long to get this. Yes, I do believe that we will see, it's nothing is zero, but it is incredibly low that we will have any sort of fully vaccinated person like me have a chance of me having it colonized in my nose and me giving it to an unvaccinated or even another vaccinated person. But those trials that have all been set up around the world were trials set up for the primary endpoint of preventing death and severe hospitalization. Everything else was considered a not essential primary goal of the trial. So the data and all of that was powered, designed, and studied for those primary endpoints, which means that asymptomatic transmission was like a nice to have, but that's what they have to study now. And what we're seeing from other countries is incredible, and we're going to have some more of that data from the US. But I would say the CDC making the recommendation that vaccinated people can get together in a small gathering with unvaccinated people at low risk is basically their way of saying, yeah, we believe that asymptomatic transmission is rare.
That's helpful translation. That's right. That's great, because it is sometimes hard to interpret those messages.
But
that's helpful. Vaccine passports, good, bad, necessary? What's your take?
Yeah, I think that some form of proof of immunity is going to be necessary. I actually think my friend Andy Slavitt, who works on like all the White House COVID stuff, who's brilliant, said it the right way. Anything that's going to be done in the United States needs to be free, interoperable from a technology perspective, and kind of multi-literate language, health literacy, et cetera. And I think those are the right three criteria. So I'm not a kind of fan of like a no offense to anybody if they're in this company, Clear, or something that causes something where someone would really have to pay into the program. We already are seeing New York State with the Excelsior Pass. I mean, I think airlines, I think all industries are thinking about this. So I do think that having something that's kind of a free government good, so to speak, that's accessible to all is the right way to do it. However, since I take care of patients who are primarily uninsured, probably the majority of them undocumented and speak, you know, are in Latinx communities in my practice, I will just be honest, I don't want there to be a perception that this is going to become some big government database, which could come back in some way to haunt them. And so I think that has to be clear also. But I think some proof of immunity is going to likely be the way forward for the entire world.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's talk a little bit about the CDC recommendations, but particularly in the context of school reopening. You and I spoke a little bit about that before. Obviously, the school question's fraught. I've been engaged with it. I know you have as well. It does seem that there's a lot more alignment around that as a question now than was the case 6 months ago. It also seems though that we're not necessarily on that sort of glide path toward all schools reopening in the autumn completely. Thoughts on that and how that interacts with CDC guidance?
Yeah, I mean, short of like some crazy curveball, which certainly a virus that's novel could do to us, it is all there should be no resistance to the notion that children are full-time in school, in person. And that includes, by the way, the possibility that all children who are not vaccinated have to wear masks. I mean, there's certainly some safeguards around that. I think what's very frustrating to all of us, the CDC putting out the guidance that came out about a month ago, technically was the first guidance we ever saw that was very detailed on schools. So personally, again, knowing how agencies operate and the government operates, I was actually pleased to see it, even though I realized it was a slightly confusing and sometimes sent mixed messages that you could have a high school because of the case rates on one block that actually was, you know, all virtual with an elementary school on that same block that was in a hybrid. And it just didn't, so you could have families with a household that had completely disparate learning examples. Despite the household actually being the same risk potentially. So I think that what we need to do is, I've always said, we're not going to feel like society is normal until we hear kids laugh and schools are open. And I don't mean open one day a week, I mean open. So I do think that it would be wonderful. Places like the partnership have a huge voice in this, because I think you do have to show how they're related. And I think we have to support teachers being, and educators, staff and others being prioritized, which they are. And I do think that there's going to be no question that anybody who wants the vaccine will get it well before the fall. And I also, by the way, will just mention 12 to 16 year olds will likely also have access to several authorized vaccines by the fall as well. And then maybe even younger than that, depending on the strength of the data. So we could be talking really, JB, about a fall that's kind of, you know, somewhat mixed. But again, without some boomerang or a wild card coming from the virus, you know, the spring of 2022, potentially maskless schools and kind of, but I do believe they should be fully open and have opportunities to have society feel a little bit more normal again.
Yeah. Well, as you pointed out, for the companies that are involved in the partnership companies generally, that's been critical path. You know, we looked at ways the companies could stand up more testing and sort of fill some of the other gaps were being left, et cetera. But the feeling was, well, even if we did all that, if folks are pinned down at home with their kids, it doesn't matter. We're still stuck.
Yeah. And that, by the way, the digital divide, I'll just say that something that should not, again, in that spirit of how you asked me about my personal experience, we should not be coming out of this not recognizing that that digital divide, broadband access, internet, that actually shouldn't just go away as a topic once kids go back in school, because I think that has also been the prevention. I think that has been one of the big, huge gaps we've seen now. It has actually prevented kind of the mobility economically. So, so that's just a comment.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. My sister is a fifth grade teacher and mostly undocumented immigrant kids in public schools out in California. And, a year ago, March, they disappeared.
Yeah.
There's just virtually, essentially no way. Let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to zoom out and then zoom back in. Are we going to have a fourth surge? Are we having a fourth surge?
Yeah, we're already seeing cases in New York, for example. I've been following a couple of the metropolitan areas very carefully. So cases are coming down about 50,000 in a 24-hour period or less, but we are still dealing with certain parts of the country, New York, for example, where cases are plateauing, and then in some zip codes and neighborhoods, cases increasing. It's unclear. We know that variants are driving that, not the UK, not the B117, B1351 or P1, UK, South Africa, or Brazil, but actually our own homegrown kind of New York variants, California variants in California. And so those are things that we're all keeping an eye on. So instead of a fourth surge, surge implies that the health systems will also be completely stretched. I don't think we'll see that. I think we'll see an increase in cases. And that means more hospitalizations and deaths, unfortunately. So that's partly why I think that businesses, humans, individuals, households are just going to have to navigate through some mixed risk. And that means that testing, which is still, in my opinion, a little bit unaffordable and inaccessible to the broad public, testing, quarantine, even if the states have lifted some of those regulations, there's going to be some hard decisions that we're going to need to probably work public health and education and business kind of communities together to sort through until we get more clarity past these increasing cases and then hopefully the kind of herd immunity or majority of people being immunized.
Great. You've been in the federal administration before. I think we've seen a lot more alignment up and down the country around response since this administration came in than we'd had. But there are always things that they could do better. What are they not doing well yet, in your view?
Yeah, I think that, you're absolutely right, JB. I've never, based on my background, you can tell I'm a Democrat, but I never think that means you just go into something blind. So I'll give you two concrete examples. Number one, I do think that the Biden administration is being a little sheepish about just going in to locales and places that are just not meeting vaccination requirements. Now we know every state is trying to get to some degree of that all eligibility soon, but we have some states that are just woefully behind and they really do. Sending FEMA has been a solution. We probably just need to just target and say, okay, now we're coming in. And I think they're trying to do that. Mm-hmm. Second is testing. I maybe I should move that up to one. It is unacceptable to me that if I want to get a PCR, it's still about $100 and $120. There is no cost to it, no cost. Everything costs them. There's no such thing as a free lunch, as my mentor used to say. So I do think that the inability to get to incredibly cheap testing for a broad scale of people is also a flaw. And then the third thing that I will by no means absolutely sugar, I will not sugarcoat at all. We have to acknowledge that Mexico having no coronavirus approach whatsoever, Canada not having a domestic manufacturing capacity, we are completely threatened by the Americas not having a strategy. And I know the last thing we want to do is say we're turning over, 10 million doses to Mexico, but we probably need to do that. And I don't have to tell you anything other than point to what's happening in my old state of Texas on the border. then to show you that, like, between dealing with surges of unaccompanied minors and families, we're setting up our own little public health crisis of its own on the border. And I would say that that deserves health attention. And that's a reason to ship as much vaccine as possible where we can without compromising our supply to, like, our neighbors, both here and abroad if we need to. Those are three areas. Testing, I'll move that one to number one. And then two, targeting parts of our country that have just been behind for different reasons. And then third is really acknowledging the threat from around us.
Yeah, it was good to see the FDA announce yesterday there some moves around approving surveillance testing at home based on. But it is tough to watch from outside because it does seem like the pace at which we could have been moving. We've done some great things.
That had to wait. What are we now? I mean, that 15 months. I mean, that was. Yeah, unacceptable to me. Unacceptable. Just unacceptable.
It does seem that, learning where the line has to move as to process with respect to things like FDA and CDC when there is an emergency is something we've got to learn, for the next time. Let me zoom way out. If you think about, apart from changes in administration and the contributions that the last administration made to the magnitude of this problem, what are we missing in terms of public health infrastructure generally? And it's really a two-part question. What do we have to make sure is in place the next time? And how much of that can be regional versus national? Because one of the things we found with the partnership is, we look at doing things regionally and it's always easy to kind of say, well, we could, but at the end of the day, shouldn't there just be a federal response instead? And let's wait until that happens.
Yeah, no, so there's nothing closer to my heart than thinking about public health infrastructure. We got it wrong in the Obama administration by not actually identifying kind of proactively what that, because we were so worried about not putting this superimposed federal, to your point, federal structure on top of local and regional. And I actually think that's the right thing to do. You should not micromanage the way counties and cities or states approach this because it is all local. But then in the absence of that guidance, there was really nothing in most of the country. And over the last four decades, public health budgets have been constantly, consistently cannibalized, regardless of governor, party, et cetera. So because it looks, until you have a pandemic, you don't really think about what public health does, but it does so much. So here's what I would say. I would say that it's time for the kind of function of public health. There's always going to be the need to have kind of the traditional public health infrastructure that does the testing and tracing. We do that with infectious diseases. We do that with water quality, things like that. I would say it's now high time to have, especially for larger size corporations or coalitions like the partnership, to have kind of a point of view on what, like, public health responsibility, private sector parties need to take. And let me give you a concrete example. I think it's incredibly relevant to have conversations with local leaders that public businesses will be willing to kind of play, whether it's through finances or personnel at the table, but are going to need to be a meaningful part of kind of surveillance as well as a meaningful part of preparedness. After 9/11, every business of any size, including small ones, had kind of a back of the envelope, terrorism plan, so to speak. We see schools now that have gun policies. I think it's high time with everything that's happened that we have some sort of kind of public health infrastructure inculcated. Not necessarily, this is not yet one more job that, like, the chief of HR, the person who helps with personnel and recruitment has to deal with. It's probably something that every leader, CEO down, has some sense of what's my kind of responsibility to the health of my population, i.e. my employees, if that's two employees or if that's 2,000 or 2 million. So I think that's the way I think about public health. Public health is, this is, C. Everett Koop taught me this when I was a lowly little medical student. Healthcare is vital to all people some of the time. Public health is vital to all people all of the time. And that's the part we kind of need to get on board with.
Yeah. How do you think about it in the context of climate change and sustainability? Yeah.
So part of every corporate kind of strategic set of goals has something to do with kind of environmental and response. Almost everybody has something around environmental responsibility or kind of pledges to green, or GM moving, any of these auto manufacturers moving to all electric fleets, et cetera. So to me, I think it's I feel like the real casualty in all of this has been science. So the science of climate change has been demonized well before the pandemic and continues to kind of be politicized and demonized. I think this is a great example of where the science of this needs to be lifted forward in a way that's accessible for everyone, including businesses, including employees. I mean, it broke my heart coming from Texas, where I could still see parts of my sister who's in Houston, my family who's in San Antonio. They would send me these kind of candid shots of like office parks that still had electricity going at night. And I'm like, haven't we done away with that? Like, who's still running office electricity at 10 o'clock at night when there's no inhabitants? And yet that's what we're doing in society, because we're just not reflecting on that interrelationship. I am not a climate change science expert. I have read the literature and feel incredibly motivated to figure out how we can introduce that into like healthcare a little bit more. But I think it is going to take that this more inclusive approach, but it's going to be intentional and it should not be, I hate the notion that we just kind of have more things for people to do rather than thinking about how it integrates into daily functions in a way that makes sense. Building engineers, yeah. People who are hiring, that type of thing.
Yeah. Well, to your point, I think to the degree CEOs have understood now that health is a primary concern for them as they think about their employees, I think they're thinking about sustainability as a primary strategic issue as well. Yeah. And you can't not have plans and be active on both.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the region and want to talk specifically about inclusion. You know, the partnership has decided that its work is going to focus on what we're calling inclusive growth. You know, the belief is that this region is one of the most diverse regions in the country. If it also becomes the most inclusive and equitable economy, the view of the partners is that will mean it's going to be the fastest growing region as well. Inclusion is kind of the new innovation for the next generation. So it's going to become the most attractive place to be, as well as the most attractive place to stay and to grow. But there's decades, centuries of history to address or to consider in the process of trying to make sure that we've got an inclusive and equitable economic approach. As you think about the region, and either in the public health context or more broadly, how do you think about, you know, inclusion, equity, diversity? How are those things going here as a region, not just within some particular jurisdiction? And where's the opportunity to improve from your vantage point?
Yeah, I think the Mid-Atlantic, because of both kind of a tradition with some HBCUs in the area, as well as this incredible, I love the area because it is kind of a melting pot. It's my husband, who's a New Yorker, kind of thinks of New York as the ultimate melting pot, and I lived in Southern California. But I think the Mid-Atlantic is an incredibly rich place from all aspects, including kind of the inclusive diversity. I mean, the dialects to the cultures to like this, I think respect, because we do tend to be an international stop for most people, is an incredible opportunity. Having said that, I would say that there's also a need to be attractive. What I've seen at places like Brookings and other places is like kind of the higher you go on SES and accomplishment, the less inclusive it is. And somebody asked me like, why is that? And I said, it's very obvious. Like, you know, if you look at social networks and you look at people at incredible high, we look at outliers as a society. We like to talk about the person that kind of bucked all the odds and became the CEO. But 99.9% of people it's a social network. And if you're not if you don't have access to that at an earlier point in your career, then you just don't have any hope. And for women, for example, so inclusivity on multiple levels, gender, kind of BIPOC, LGBTQ, all of it, it's all about points of accessibility. So I think that, to me, I think we're doing well. I like this, you know, I like to give us grades, because I think I was a teacher in a former life, in future life. And I think that in the Mid-Atlantic, like I would give us like a C, and I'd give a lot of the country a D or an F. And I'd say we're a C with a rising kind of goal, because I do think the intentionality is there and the pieces are there. But I think we have to be very honest. The hardest thing to do is to do what I had to do after the spate of violence against women in Atlanta. And I had to accept that, like, I play a role in that, even though I look the way I do, I play a role in that. And I think very carefully, about the environments in which I'm in and kind of the rooms I sit in. And it's, I struggle. So I think that in order to continue to do what you're talking about, JB, how can we create a better place for us to struggle in a way that doesn't somehow also alienate people who kind of feel like, well, I don't get it. I'm inclusive, you know, and that's the part that's hard. And I do feel, I don't think it comes, I know there's been a rash of kind of, you know, equity officers or appointments. And I think that's necessary to show in organizations that are usually large, that there's money, people, time, and resources. But this goes back to kind of public health and everything. How is it that I'm thinking, you know, what's the one thing I'm doing to kind of not face, not to look at myself honestly and create change in my organization? And so for most of us in the Mid-Atlantic, we're doing a lot, can always do better. It's why I gave us a C and we're rising. But I would highlight for me, it's been meaningful to think about the earlier points of access. So some people think that's a mentorship program. I think it's actually fostering. I'm a big believer in like the strength of weak ties. And JB, you're a good example. You and I kind of met very casually, informally. I have such deep respect for what you do. If you were to tell me you're thinking about recruiting someone and how can we find someone in this environment, that's going to be the kind of ties that create those networks that then help people kind of all ages, sizes, shapes, and colors rise. And I just don't think we know how to do that well, because even I fall into patterns where I'm very comfortable with the people I know, and I'm very uncomfortable with things I don't understand. And that's definitely where I think our region can do better. And so a takeaway is that, you know, how are we promoting like informal networks or strange bedfellows or people like the two of us kind of talking and working? Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I you know, I do worry about how much we've fallen back. You know, you talk about points of accessibility, just awareness of implicit bias, just lots of things where there was a lot of progress being made. And now suddenly, you know, 2 million women are out of the workforce. And, yeah. You know, right. we've had CEOs of some of our big firms, the consulting firms in particular, who said, look, you know, we've got folks who are in their early mid 20s for whom 18 months of their professional career will have been remote. And during those 18 months, that, you know, that would have been the jungle gym of opportunity normally. Yeah. And instead it's, you know, they've got to try to figure out how to navigate that network in some remote fashion. So, you know, it could feel okay to work remotely, but in fact, a lot of those points of accessibility have been broken by how we've had to work.
I know. Especially if you're new to I just think you're absolutely, I personally think that this is the greatest opportunity for our region though, because we are, let's be honest, whatever business we are in this area, we take incredible pride at that kind of melting pot diversity. We do. I mean, it is so amazing to be able to travel 10 miles and have an incredibly heterogeneous experience. And so that is both an attractor and a detractor. And so you have to fight hard to kind of change, like, you have to fight hard to change and also accept kind of with, I mean, I fight every day and I say very publicly, God, I am racist in some of the things I've said or done, but I'm going to be okay with trying to learn how to not do that. And my gender bias about certain, you know, I've seen sometimes environments where women, I have actually seen women not really help other women for fear of being seen as, oh, you're the one woman who kind of helps all the other women. And so you want to play with like an environment that can be largely male and not be seen as the token female kind of mentee mentor. And that's something we all have to fight. And I have to do it all the time. So I say as a standing rule, any woman, actually anybody who's young who wants to like connect or network, I can miss an email or two, but I never say no.
Yeah.
And I think that's not possible for everyone, but some version of people have to have their scale for something like that and make room.
Yeah. I 100%. I that's my mantra. And, you know, regret saying this publicly again, but, you know, I always respond. And, you know, and I've got like a little curated thing that I send to, depending on what the nature of the query is, but it's like, here are 5 links that matter to you. And, you know, boom.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah. No, that's great. And that's something you learn with time. And so, you know, how do we impart that on people who are maybe at lower level, mid level, kind of having that be part of like what they just do? And then those social networks open up a little bit.
Yeah, agree with that. Let me shift a little bit. I know you've been consulting a lot of businesses over the last while. What have you learned in that process?
I have learned that there is no such thing as like a funny question about COVID. Like the questions that come up, they're incredibly important. There's no such thing as a stupid question. It's true. I mean, there's just so much misinformation out there. Yeah. What I've learned is that it's very hard to find clear, and what people want is kind of clear, concise guidance. Like they're willing to even be told you can't have your workers in person, but they need to be told that. And so I would say, again, what I've learned, and I hope that people aren't spending, I know people are spending a lot of money to get this advice. What I've observed is that a lot of what we give to mostly large corporations that are global is advice that really should be liberated and democratized in some way. So I've tried to do that by kind of working with people like you or trying to kind of liberate that, whether it's, media or my little world, but that's what I've learned. And then the second thing is that I've also learned that in that spirit of CDC guidance, businesses are still left without much to operate with in terms of how do I keep people safe? How do I bring them back safe? What do I do if someone gets sick? And so another thing that kind of I've tried to encourage the C-suite to do is to do what we do in public health, which are tabletop exercises. Think through your worst scenarios and how people will respond. And a lot of it is the emotional response, because if you have a plant with remote workers, a call center with workers who are spaced apart, et cetera, but you have a hot spot developed with 10 people who get sick or one person whose family person member dies, that becomes psychological, but you can plan for it. So that's been also an observation, is that we just don't do enough what I would call tabletop exercises or the what if scenarios. And then the third is kind of this meaningful like commitment around going forward. One day this will be in our rear view. What responsibility now do we have as employers? Everybody's scrambling to provide vaccines for their employees. Well, what could we take away from that so that 2 years from now, 3 years from now, we're still screening? Could we do mammogram, could we bring mammogram trailers so that every woman over the age of 45 gets screened easily in the convenience of the parking lot of their employer? Could we do colonoscopy screenings, not the full on, but like we can do fecal. We have technology that can allow for so much, that prevents so much disease to be done. It's just convenience. So yeah. I think that's the third thing. Like, where are we looking forward? And a friend of mine just became like, I forget his title. It's like chief Delta Airlines hired like forever, first ever, the first chief, I want to say health officer or something like that. I don't think you have to do that. Businesses don't have the budget or EBITDA or whatever to do that. But I think having that notion going beyond, I offer health as a benefit, is very well, it would be good advice to heed.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think there is a lot that they can learn. I do think you and I spoke a little bit about this. I do think a number of the CEOs still feel like they're kind of in the caboose.
They are in the caboose, JB. Yeah. They are. And so I'm offering, I think there are some real practical things that businesses in the next 6 months are going to need. Should I be testing? If someone's is sick, do they need to be quarantined? If someone's family member is sick, what allowances should I make? How can I encourage people who don't want to get vaccinated to get vaccinated? They're all left without none of these specifics. Not one. Yeah.
It's been tough too. I think a lot of them have tried to learn how to talk to public health authorities.
Oh, they're not the right people.
Yeah, right. It's tough.
They're understaffed, undervalued, underappreciated, overworked. They're kind of like, wait, you don't have, they're like, look, I don't care. I'm friends with some of them and I've had like interactions where I've said, no, you need to take this seriously. And it's been really hard. So yeah, it's been incredibly difficult.
Yeah. It has been interesting trying to broker some of those conversations because, the poor public health folks, I'll just give you one example. The company will say something like, look, we've got sites where we can do massive vaccinations really soon. Like,
no. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's even tougher because they'll say things like, as long as our employees are first in line. And like, if you're the public health person on the other end, you're like, I can't respond to either part of that query, right? Yeah. Because, I'm not ready to think about mass vaccination sites because I don't have any vaccines and I cannot possibly say yes to the second thing.
Right. Yeah. Which is, you asked about where Biden could step in more.
Yeah.
Having the ability to allow for those types of relationships to happen through some form, it won't be through county, state public health agencies, but having some ability to do that, I think would have been, again, I like to say hindsight 2020, these things are nice to have, but these are the kinds of things that I hope do get baked into at least a federal pandemic preparedness kind of response and thinking about other things, because this isn't going to go away.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Next 6 months are going to, we've talked a lot about the path to inclusive growth is through inclusive recovery, that there's just been such damage done that even with things like the rescue plan, et cetera, the reality is that 6 months from now, the proportion of small businesses that are going to be able to look like they did pre-pandemic is small, you know, particularly in urban, core urban areas. If you think about, you know, sort of the DC government or forget which entity, but where should we be focused on trying to help those entities beyond what's already happening so that they're there in 6 months and so that they're also ready for the new world of work, et cetera? What comes to mind is we talk a lot about it. But I think small businesses in particular, they're, you know, largely owned by to a much greater degree by underrepresented people, women as well. And they've just been decimated.
Yeah. So I, having sat on like the side of the recovery in 2009, what we really needed was, I know this sounds trite, we needed actionable kind of data. We needed to understand what were the three key drivers for downturn. So we're about to talk about a very large federal infrastructure package. Much of that will flow to these entities we're talking about, JB. It's not like the federal government is going to manage all of it. But this was like the eternal struggle I had. I actually had to work on this. Like, what do small businesses need short of just checks and cash? What would be helpful? And we, when we turned to some of the small business, we turned to the usual customary councils and organizations and partnerships, et cetera. But you were not equipped to speak kind of government-ese and say, we need direct checks. We also need, you know, X percentage to be forgiven off of energy costs because those are killing us. Or so it would be nice to highlight what are three priorities, probably aside from direct cash, because I think that's an assumption. What are three high priorities? Is it just zero interest loans? Like, is the PPP, was that the savior of all saviors so that you could actually do whatever you needed to do? Was it some sort of other tax credit? I'm not a big tax. I find that tax credits are problematic as a Democrat because they often help those who have the capital to kind of front that, not necessarily the rear view, but it might be, I might be wrong. And so I would say, could you identify three things aside from direct stimulus checks that would be high priority actions? And you'd be shocked at how hard it is to get those things together. And so in the absence of that kind of concrete feedback, what we end up having are the conversations I'm listening to now where they're like, well, let's just put out like a, let's put out a jobs package and let's just pour money into certain sectors. And so, and I'm like, is that the right thing to do? You know, but nobody knows, nobody knows. And so, yeah, that would be great. And any data to support it, you talked about 2 million women. What's it going to take to get those women back into the workplace, right? And so, those are the things that could be really helpful.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, Congress, as much as I love them, you know, senators and congresspeople aren't trained to do this. So you feed it and they can take it and put it into what they need to do, but create the channels for entities that we're talking about to be able to deploy it, including the partnership.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, we're at the end of our time, and I knew it was going to go really quickly. Just a last question. I had heard on a podcast you did recently, not ours, that you were going to go out to a restaurant. Did you have a chance to do that?
I did. How was it? My husband and I, just the two of us, we went to a restaurant. We felt really weird because we just felt really weird, and it was great. And just to promote, you know, Fabio Truck Del Mar in like the Navy or the Harbor area and the waterfront area. It was wonderful. We wanted to spend as much money as we could, like that is the restaurant, but like I went to like
more champagne, more buy that.
There's a guy selling s'mores. Like it was just such a, there are going to be those moments, JB. I hope my closing thought is like the little things are just going to feel so great and you should relish that. Like there's this horribleness that's happened, but it was so fun. I didn't think being at a restaurant would be so enjoyable. And like talking to the wait staff who I couldn't have had more people come up and thank us for like coming. And literally they were like, thank you for coming and spending your money. And that's how, this is the America that when you ask like, what are we doing about diversity and inclusion? That's the kind of thing that like, I will love hearing children laughing going to restaurants. We will meet at a restaurant. You know, that's going to happen soon. And yeah. I was very happy. So hopefully you're doing something like that for yourself at some point.
Well, soon for sure. But look, thank you. My guest has been Dr. Kavita Patel, who's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Great conversation, much appreciated. And I look forward to multiplying points of accessibility for many people with you in the years to come. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, JP. Thanks to the partnership.
Thanks for tuning in to Fresh Take. This episode was produced by Jenna Klein, Justin Matheson-Turner, and Coley Tuzel. If you like what you heard, share it with your network. For more information and to access all of our podcasts, events, and publications, visit greaterwashingtonpartnership.com.